So we've come through the first, actually a few sets of parables so far, the first few sets, and there's a couple of more sets left to go. We are in Luke, beginning in chapter 16 this week. We're following Christ city by city on his way to Jerusalem and to Calvary. It may surprise you, but we're only about two chapters away from the triumphal entry. We're actually, I noticed that this week as I was preparing and got a little sad because this Luke series might be long, but it's been very, very rich, at least for me. Since chapter 9, Jesus turned his and set his face to go to Jerusalem, and the teaching and instruction has grown in its urgency and its intensity. The message that he brought was that the kingdom of God had come near, that Christ had been sent to save the lost, to heal the sick, to cleanse the filthy, to forgive sins, to reveal God's glory and his grace and his mercy. Bottom line, Christ was sent to save sinners. He has taught his disciples how to love, how to have compassion, what the priorities are, love and mercy. He's taught them how to pray. He's taught them how to draw close to God. He's called them to carry forth this message. He's taught them how to walk as he walks, following him, and he's told them it's a blessed life. He's warned them of the traps and the snares of worldly living, to be wary of hypocrisy, focusing on the outward morality while neglecting inward love for God. He's warned them of fearing men. He's warned them of trusting in their own strength and resources. He's admonished his followers not to be anxious in anything. Basically, whether it's food or clothes or life, that you should trust in God, seek his kingdom first, and all these things shall be added unto you. He's told them to always be ready, dressed for action, lamps lit, to be found faithful and wise, for he's coming at an hour that they don't expect. Therefore, the time is now to repent or to perish. And the set of parables dealt with fruitfulness, bearing fruit, allowing God to grow and change and mature us. Remember, he gave the picture of mustard seeds that start out really small, but grow into big, huge bushes. He talked about leaven that gets into the dough and it permeates everything. Allow God to change us. And then Christ turned his attention to the Pharisees and the scribes, healing on the Sabbath. He challenged all of their false impressions of who God was and what pleased God. He authored another set of parables directed to this pharisaical heart. If you remember these, don't take the best seat. Don't always strive to be first. Don't always strive to have the best. Don't always look after yourself. Don't always be at work looking after your own family and your own friends. Invite and serve strangers, those who can't repay you. Go after the crippled, the blind, the lame, the cast-outs, the ne'er-do-wells. He told the scribes and the Pharisees, many who think they're in will be very surprised to find themselves out. To his disciples then he turned and he said, those who would truly follow him must love him most. They must leave all else. They must take up their own cross. They must count the cost and be willing to pay it. He ends that session with a follower who doesn't follow isn't worth much, right? Salt that isn't salty, what good is it? Then the next set of parables was spoken to those who didn't understand yet why Jesus was so close to sinners, why he received sinners, why he spent so much time with the lost and the sick. He gave the picture of the shepherd that leaves the 99 to bring back the one that was lost. He gave the picture of the woman who was relentlessly searching everywhere for the lost coin. He gave the picture of the father who goes out to bring in his prodigal son and that same father who goes out to bring his resentful son. And what he showed us in each of those parables is what really delights the father, what really brings joy to heaven. And that joy that's uncontainable is regaining what was lost. God's delight in seeing what was broken rebuilt, the lost found, the dead brought to life. And so today now we come to another set of parables given to his disciples. And I think if you want, as a way of introduction, knowing what really delights the Father, what is the great delight of heaven? This idea that the lost are found, that the prodigals are brought in, that the dead are brought to life. These next set of parables then are, what should then we be doing? What should be the priority of the life of the Christian while there's still time left here on this planet? What should we be about? And so we go into this next set of parables that's going to lead us to Zacchaeus, which then leads us to Jerusalem. And so we're coming through to this next set of parables that are going to be a little intrusive into your life, because they're going to confront you with, what are you doing with your life today? What are you doing with your time? What are you doing with your resources? There's only so much time left. How should you be spending them? And so we come to Luke chapter 16, beginning with verse 1. He also said to his disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And so he called him and he said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be my manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you to the true riches? If you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." And go just one more verse, verse 14. "The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things, and they ridiculed him." So be careful, because you have this response, right? Luke gives us the response, and so that's not the right response to the sermon you're about to hear today. So we begin with opening up this parable. I will let you know that this parable is a parable that not a lot of people like. It's one of the unpopular parables. The reason is when you read it, most people take it and they have to start figuring out, well, it seems like Christ is promoting something that we shouldn't be promoting. And so we either have to change what it is he's promoting, or we have to kind of give a reason for the, and we get really twisted in the parable. And I think it's so oftentimes because we put too much extra stuff into the parables, and we need to stick to the main point that the author is giving us. And so we're going to look at this parable that seems backward and wrong. Let's see how backward it is. Verse 1, there's a rich man and he has a manager. This manager, the term that's used there is a steward. We've talked about stewards in a few of the parables that we've had already before. What is a steward? It's someone who is given charge of his master's accounts. This is the manager. So this isn't just a lower steward. This is a manager who has signatory authority. This is a manager who is managing the accounts of his master. And ultimately, charges are brought to the master to let him know that there's something he should be aware of. And what he should be aware of was that this manager was wasting the master's possessions. Wasting the possessions. Now, I want you to see right off the bat that his job was to manage the master's resources well, which means he was supposed to put his master's resources to profitable use. Now, it may not be profitable in the way we think it's profitable. What was most important is that he did it in the way the master wanted his resources used. And so the whole idea of this manager was to manage in a way that the master wanted him to manage them in. Sometimes it wasn't necessarily profitable, but we think it's profitable in the master's eyes. And so the idea isn't so much that it needed, this isn't the 10 talents that, you know, the 5 talents that you make another 5 talents. This is different. This is the fact that he was entrusted with the master's property and money and wealth and accounts. And I want you to manage them a very specific way. And what he was doing was he was wasting his master's resources. what's interesting is oftentimes, as we've talked about stewards, a couple of things that happen with stewards. First one is they get too comfortable with their master's goods, right? This happens in business, trust me. Anyone that's led folks, right, and you entrust them with your things, the first thing that starts to happen is over time, they start to think that those things belong to them. And they start using those things in the way they want to use those things, not necessarily the way you want them to use those things. The second is that they begin to think that there's never going to be an accounting. I managed some shill stations way back in another life. And I was really shocked because on an audit, I found out that we had been losing a lot of product. And so we had to bring in some folks to do an audit on all of our stations to find out where was the loss coming from. And in my mind, there was only one shady character that I had working for me that I thought it was probably that shady character. And so I wasn't afraid at all about bringing in a lie detector. And so we brought in a guy that was basically going to interview all of our folks to find out where the graph was. And the lie detector guy told me, it's probably all of your folks. I'm like, no, I handpicked these people. I know these people. These are my friends. I love these. No, that's not going to be. He says, I won't even have to turn the machine on. He says, I'll have confessions before I even turn the machine on. 2 days later, I had one of my very first lessons that has always stayed with me. Every single one of my employees, on every shift, had a Coke and a candy bar. And they were like, it's just a Coke and a candy bar. What they didn't realize is over 6 months, that $3, 5 days a week, adds up to the point where the station was down $3,000, $4,000. They didn't realize that that Coke and candy bar accumulated to a point where they could really get into a lot of trouble. What they lost sight of was they thought they deserved it. They thought that this was mine. I'm here. I'm doing all the work. I don't get paid a whole lot, so I'm going to supplement my own wages. Those are the problems that we have when we're given stewardship of other people's things. And it's not just some of us. All of us start to think of them as our own. We start to think there's going to be no accounting. And we get wasteful, especially with other people's things. First side note, do you see where this parable is headed? Do I have to go further in the parable for you to understand where this parable is headed? There's a manager who's been entrusted with his master's resources, and the charge is he's been wasteful with them. So if we understand who the master is and we understand who the managers are, we kind of already start having an application. It's kind of settling into our hearts already, right? And so I think this is easier maybe to uncover than a lot of people try and make it out to be. Wasted. One of the things I want you to get out of this is a lot of the commentaries, and I did myself, the first couple of days, I went with several of them. It was my thought as well, was that he was using this stuff for himself. Because remember a couple of the parables we had earlier, that was the issue, right? They were using this stuff for himself. That's not this one, right? This one's got a different point. And so don't pull last month's parable into this parable. Stick to this parable. The word that he uses is, he was wasting it. Now, he might have been using some of that stuff for himself, but that wasn't really the point. The point is that he was wasting the resources. He was entrusted with his master's wealth, and instead of managing it well, he was wasting it. He wasn't doing what the master wanted with it. He was unfaithful to his master's trust. That's important. Verse 2, so the master calls his steward in and he says to him, what's this I hear about you? Now, is he really asking? We know he's not really asking. We know that he probably already knows the answer because he interrupts. He doesn't wait for an answer. He says, turn in your account of the management because you can no longer be my manager. There isn't a response. This isn't a two-way conversation. Do you know what I've heard about you? Do you know what I've come to realize? Do you know what I've come to understand? You've been misusing and wasting the resources that have been entrusted with you. And so what he tells them is you need to turn in the books for an accounting. Scary thing. I will tell you, when that shell manager, when I had these three stations, whenever I said we have an audit coming, two of the managers would be like, okay. And one of my managers would be like, oh. I didn't even have to do the audit at that point, right? Just the idea that an audit was coming would send one into the knees knocking. Why? Because he knew he wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing. He wasn't managing that station well. He wasn't keeping control of the things that had been entrusted to him. And now someone's going to look at it and it's scary. Don't know what we're going to find. So here we have it. I want you to understand that the way this is the language that's brought forward in the story, this isn't the boss saying, "You're fired." This is actually a fairly gentle, good boss who basically says, "Because of your wasting of the entrusted money, I have to let you go. I can't let you be a manager over this anymore." Right? This isn't get out of here, I'm gonna take you, you know, your head off. This is, you just can't do this anymore. I can't afford to have you entrusted with my things anymore because I can't trust you to manage it well. So this manager says to himself, and I want you to see that in that term right there, basically he starts thinking to himself. And what does he think to himself? What am I going to do? My stewardship has been taken away. My job, my manager job has been taken away. He starts thinking about what? His future. He hasn't been thinking about his future all along. He's got this great job. He's got this cushy job where all he has to do is manage the accounts. And so he's not thinking about tomorrow. He's not thinking about his future. He's just living in the moment, doing his own thing. And all of a sudden, when this is going to be taken away, where does his mind go? What's going to happen tomorrow? What's going to happen next month? What's going to happen next year? What's going to happen? No one's going to trust me. Think about the time this was written. You get fired from a job like this, let go for trust. Who else is going to let you be a steward? He realizes his stewardship days is over. I guess I could be a laborer. Nope. I've been sitting at a desk writing with my pen too long. I don't think I can be a laborer. I can't be a beggar. I've got too many suits. Right? Anyone get to that point where you start worrying about what's coming next? Any of you guys who start having trouble in your job? And what keeps you up till 3 in the morning? What am I going to do? How many of you have those thoughts that are kind of like, well, I guess I put that floor in up at the cabin. I could be a floorer. I put a roof in once. I could be a roofer. And then you start looking at yourself going, yeah, don't think I'm built to be a roofer. Right? I don't want to be a beggar. Which family members do I know that could, gosh, what could happen to us? This is where he's at. What's going to happen next? What am I going to do? How am I going to live? Now that he's faced with reality that this life that he's known is ending, he's got to do something. He's got to think hard and fast about taking care of himself in the next. You see this? And he figures it out. Right? Fear is a powerful motivator. You see, his quandary is, how will I fare after this? How will I eat? Where will I stay? Who will help me? Who will receive me? How will I take care of myself? That's what's consuming his thoughts. And all of a sudden he says, I got it. Says, I decided what to do. I know how to be received. Right? This is the word. I know how to be received. Remember that word from the last couple of times? Received. I know what it's going to take for people to be nice to me after I lose this job. People who will take care of me. People who will owe something to me. People that will be favorably disposed to me. I know how to make people like me so that after this job in this next life, I'm going to be taken care of. I got it. So, verse 5. He summons all the master's debtors. And one by one, I want you to understand, there's not just two debtors. This master has a lot of debtors. They give you two examples of many debtors. And what does he do? He brings them in. He asks them a question. How much do you owe my master? The first one says, 100 measures of oil. I want you to know, beloved, that's no small amount. 100 the measures of oil. I'll tell you when he cuts it, right? He tells him quickly, take your account, take your bill, write 50. What? Just write 50. Okay. He changes the 100 to a 50. You know what he just gave that man? 50 measures of oil. That's about 500 gallons of oil. It's the yield of 146 olive trees. Basically, it's 2 to 3 years' wages that he just gave back to this debtor. And the next one that came in said, how much do you owe? 100 measures of flour, 100 measures of wheat. He says, change your account, change the bill, make it 80 measures. 20 measure discount, that's about 200 bushels of wheat. That's about a half a year's salary. These are just two of several. Do you see what he's doing? He still has accounts. He still has authority. The master didn't take away his authority. He says, turn over your books. So I needed a couple days to clean out the books. And he's certainly cleaning out the books for his master. And what's he doing? He's bringing in all of these debtors. And what is he doing? He's making nice with them. Are they going to like this guy? They're going to love this guy. And I guarantee you, as he's going, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch my back, right? You got it? There's a lot of winking going on. There's a lot of stuff going on. And ultimately, he has authority. And so if he wants to do it, the people that are debtors is like, hey, I'm down for that. Some writers talk about that he was legally able to do this because the manager would always add an interest, and in the Bible they weren't allowed to add interest, and so this is probably the interest that had been added into the amount, and he was probably just taking the interest out and all this. Why? Because they don't want to have to deal with what comes next, right? They want to make this somehow palatable. But Jesus calls him a dishonest manager. So he's dishonest. This is not a good thing that he's doing. It's a dishonest act that he takes. So that's wrong. It doesn't matter to this. What's important is, why was he doing it? That's what Jesus wants to look at. Why was this guy doing this? While he's still the steward, he decides he's going to make friends with all those who are going to help him later. Those who would think well of him. I'm losing my job anyway. So I'm going to cleverly, and my master has entrusted this to me. The master is probably not going to know to the extent I did this, right? So he cleverly planned for his own future, using his position and his resources now for his future good. That's worth writing down if you're writing notes. He used his position and his resources now for his future good. If only he had done that for his master before. But what's happening is, all of a sudden, now he's thinking, right? Now when he's faced with, my future is right upon me, I got to do something now. Now he's thinking cleverly. Wouldn't it have been nice if he'd been a clever manager, a shrewd manager but it's only now when he's faced with the premise of a future that he's going to have to take care of that he gets motivated. Now, the master's response is what causes the listeners to scratch their heads, the commentators to stumble, and the readers to kind of double take. What? This is why this is not a popular parable. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. What? This manager isn't commending him for his stewardship. No, he's being let go because he's a bad steward. He's not being commended for his honesty. Matter of fact, Jesus calls him dishonest. He's not commending him for his dishonesty. That's not what Jesus is pointing out. He's not commending him for the plan. He's commending him for one thing: his shrewdness, cleverness. One way of defining that is sharp-wittedness, thinking on his feet. That's what this manager is commending him. The master calls him out for commendation. This word means public praise and applause. One thing you should applause on this guy is the fact that, look at him. You got to admit, he's thinking smart. Right? He's taken some action, and he's actually thought on his feet. And so what the master is basically, you got to give him credit. Now, finally, this manager is acting smart. He's finally using his head. He's finally looking to the future. And then Jesus goes on with another troubling thing that he says. He says, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. This is just a truism. These worldly sons, he's talking about people like this manager, These people that are not following Christ, these people that are not fearing God, these people that are of the world, they're awful smart. They're really clever when it comes to taking care of themselves with regard to their own generation. They kind of learn how to survive. These worldly sons, these worldly folks, they work, they scheme, they plan, they manipulate, they scratch, they kick their way to make their way in this world. They're always worried about what comes next, how they will use their money to take care of themselves in the next phase of life. They do what they have to do to get ahead. They make sure that they'll be taken care of. They make sure they're going to get theirs. They make sure that in the end, they're going to be able to stay ahead. He says, that's the way these worldly guys are. They're really good at this. They're more shrewd in dealing with their generation than these sons of light. These sons of the world are consumed with making sure their next phase is taken care of, and they're shrewd with their money and their purposes and their possessions and their resources, much more than the sons of light. Who are they, these sons of light? Turn with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. I think you probably know. I don't have to go here, but 1 Thessalonians 5. Now, concerning the times and the seasons, brothers, you have no need to have anything written to you, for you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. Right? So Paul's writing to people that get this, people that are believers. While people are saying there's peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they'll not escape. But you're not in darkness, brothers, for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light, children of the day. We're not of the night. We're not of the darkness. So let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. Then he kind of goes on, right? Children of light, children of the day. These are the people that are fully aware that the day of the Lord is coming. These are the people that are aware that there is an accounting that's going to come. These are the people that have feared the Lord and understand that there is an afterlife. There is an eternity. It matters what we do today in the future. Children of light, they're not surprised. They don't sleep like others do. They're awake. They're sober. They put on faith and love and salvation. They're saved ones. God's children, believers. And what Jesus is saying is they're not as clever. They're not as shrewd in taking care of themselves in this generation, in this worldly world. They're not like the sons of this world. They're not like this dishonest manager. They aren't thinking as much. They're not thinking as sharply. They're not thinking as cleverly how to use the resources that they have for the next life. You get that? That's the parable. That's the truth. Then he comes with three teaching points from this parable. A little hard to take. Verse 9, and I tell you, whenever you get to the end, I tell you, he says, here's the point of the parable. Here's the point that I'm making. Here's the point that I want you to listen to. Here's the point I want you to get. Make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. That's a hard one. Right? You look at that one. Make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. You got to go back and understand, how did the dishonest manager make his friends? Right? Because he's linking it back. I want you to do more of what this dishonest manager did, what these children of the world do. I don't want you to be worldly. There's one aspect of them that I want you to pick up. Right? One aspect. The one aspect I want you to pick up is I want you to start thinking a little more sharply. I want you to start thinking a little more cleverly, to be a little more shrewd. That's what he's pulling forward. This dishonest manager made friends. He used his resources and he used his position to do what? To reduce their burden. So that in the future they would be favorably disposed to him. That's how he made friends with them in this next life. He used the resources he had at his disposal in order to make friends for the next portion of his life. So, you children of light, do likewise by means of unrighteous wealth. That's one of the words that everyone has a hard time with. What that means is worldly wealth. That means the wealth that you accumulate here, earthly goods, earthly wealth, your salary, your money, your savings, your inheritance. What do you got here? Use what you got here, your money made, accumulated here, to make friends with it who will receive you there. See what he's saying? There's a point he's making. This guy was smart enough to see that what he does today with this money will affect his life in the next. He used the money that he had to make friends with those who would take care of him later. And so Jesus is telling his disciples and the others listening, I want you to do likewise. I want you to be smart enough to see that what you do today with your money, your time, your resources, will affect your life in the next. Remember from the amassed treasure in heaven, where moth doesn't destroy, where the things don't decay, where the thieves don't break in. This isn't saying that you want to buy your way into heaven. This isn't to say that you're wanting to invest and you get a bigger house when you get to heaven. This isn't to say you want more friends than everybody else has when you get to heaven. Christ goes to secure a place for us. That's not his point. He's dealing with these lessons. This first lesson he's bringing out is, use your temporal wealth. You know what that word temporal means? Your temporary wealth. Because what can you take with you? What? You know what you find? You know one of the things I find when I'm visiting some of the folks that are in the hospital in the last few days of their life? All of their worldly possessions, everything that they own, has to be contained in the little teeny tiny drawer that's on the little stand that they have that they get their juice bottle from. A few pictures, right? A couple of mementos. You know, my mom, a little video game. Everything that you've accumulated in your life fits into that little drawer. And even the stuff that's in that little drawer doesn't go with you. It's all temporary. And so what he's saying is use your temporary wealth to make everlasting friends. He's pointing to what was commendable. This man, what's commendable in this manager is he's no longer wasting resources. He's now thinking smartly how best to use his resources for the thing that he cares most about. And what does he care most about? Him, right? I got to make sure that I'm taken care of. And so what he's doing is he's using what he's got now to make sure that the thing he cares most about is taken care of. Jesus says, we, the children of light, we don't do this enough. We waste resources that are entrusted to us, money, time, and talents. We need now to be thinking more smartly how best to use them for what we care about most in the future. Oh, there's a side note. So what do you care most about in the future? Show me your checkbook and I can tell you what it is. What should it be? Right? What was the last whole set of parables about? What brings joy to heaven? What is it that pleases our Father the most out of anything? It's to see the lost ones found. It's to see those that are in the dark come to the light. It's to see those that are dead come to life, right? That's what brings joy to our Father. So what's the most important thing in our life? Wouldn't it be to do what's pleasing to Him? And so, in order to take care of what's most pleasing to Him, the thing that's most important in our life, I need to use what I got right now in order to do that, to take care of that. One lost sheep, one lost coin, one lost son. How can I invest to help him find more? Start thinking how to put your earthly wealth to heavenly use. Another one worth writing. I like that one. That was one that I came up with that I wrote for myself. How do I put my earthly wealth to heavenly use, where it will actually matter for eternity? How do I take temporary dollars and make them eternal? I make friends there with my wealth here. Are you starting to pick this up? We can't take this stuff out of our life. There's only one thing that makes it into heaven. His word and his people. So where are we going to invest our money? We're going to invest in getting his people there. Where is your cleverness being used? Where is your shrewdness being used, beloved? Is it to amass wealth here? How many of you spend too much time focused on amassing wealth here? Looking for the next phase of your life, the next few months of your life, the next few years of your life. How do I get from here to there? And we spend so much time actively planning, plotting, meeting with people, studying, getting help with people, right? We do all of this stuff. And it's not to say that that's bad, but think about how much time you spend for that versus how much time you spend thinking about where your money is going to go to invest in eternal things. And 67,000 years from now, I want you to think about when you're sitting there in heaven, during that 70 years that you spent back in those early 2000s, was it time well spent? Was it money well invested? We don't spend enough time thinking about how we can use what we have now to make friends there, to allow us to use what's been given to us for his use, for his purposes, investing smartly, consistently in the gospel. What Paul said earlier as he read the scripture is basically what? Where your treasure is, that's where your heart is also. Gosh, that kind of wrecks us, doesn't it? I've only gotten through one of the applications of these three, and I'm going to stop there because I'm out of time, and I don't want to go fast through the next two applications because I think this is a big deal for us. I think it's a big deal for us as a church. I think it's a big deal for me as a pastor. I will tell you, this one punched me in the face as much as it might be punching you in the face this week. This idea of stewardship and wasting. Because a lot of us can sit there and say, well, you know what? I don't really spend it on myself. Right? And so we kind of give ourselves a pass. Because I'm not a glutton with my money. I'm not selfish with my money. I'm really generous with my money. But when we stop and think, am I using my resources for his purposes? Or am I wasting them? That's a different conversation, isn't it? That opens up a different light. And if it's not just money, some of you go, well, I don't have any much money, so I'm not in that much trouble today. You know what? How are you using your time? How are you using your gifts? How are you using what God has entrusted you to use? Are you using it for Him? Using what you have now, knowing that there is a day coming, right? There's only so much that's eternal. And so I'm going to stop there today, and we'll leave it there. We'll pick up there next week with lessons 2 and 3. I think this is important. Hopefully the Spirit will get us into this area. I will tell you, I'll warn you right now, this isn't the last parable that deals with this subject. The next 4 or 5 is almost like a pummeling effect to let us know that we are wasteful, we are selfish, we are very often not looking forward, because so oftentimes we're more concerned with next year than we are with eternity. We're more concerned with what we can see in our face right here in front of us than we are with what the Lord would have us to do. And what it does is it shows us where our trust is. Right? Our trust is in our bank account. Our trust is in our IRA. Our trust is in our retirement. Our trust is in this allocation that we've built up. Our trust, and if that's